the National Archives podcast series. Frederick Woodford, a crewman on Titanic, presented by James Cronin.
This talk is not so much about Titanic itself. Rather, it is about the lives involved in the event, the impact upon their families and upon the community of Southampton. And this talk is also an attempt to relate less talked about aspects of the story, such as the recovery of the bodies, the reporting of the event in the local press, and attempts to raise money to support those left destitute by the tragic loss of life. To do so, I will use my great-grandfather, Frederick Woodford, as a case study, looking at his life and his family and what happened to them in the aftermath of the sinking. Frederick Woodford was born in 1871. He was the son of Francis and Charlotte Woodford, nee Bound. He was one of 11 children. Francis had 4 children by his first wife, Eliza, and 7 more by Charlotte. Frederick was the middle of these. He was born in Boulder, on the edge of the New Forest, in Norley Wood. In the 1881 census, he appears there with his father and mother and some of his siblings, his older brothers, Henry, Arthur and Frank, his younger brothers, Horace and George, and his baby sister, Maud. I have a map of the small holding in Norley Wood, which marks out William and Charlotte's plot, NOR7, and a photograph of their cottage, taken in 1964 when it was still standing. The cottage is a small whitewashed building, typical of the area, and is likely to have had only 2 or 3 rooms. It seems incredible to modern sensibilities that a large family could be brought up in such crowded accommodation. Frederick moved to Southampton around the time of the 1901 census. It was whilst in Southampton that he met Susan Anstey, my great-grandmother, who was born on Brownsea Island off Poole, Dorset. Frederick and Susan married in April 1902. Her father, William Anstey, had died by then, and her mother, Elizabeth, had remarried, this time to George Pierce, who signed the marriage certificate as a witness with his cross, along with Susan's sister, Charlotte Anne, or Annie. I believe that Susan came to Southampton from Dorset because of her sister Annie. She had already settled in Southampton and had married John Henry Hodges, and we find Susan in the 1901 census staying with her sister and brother-in-law at 16 Stanford Street in the parish of St Mary's. Susan appears to have found work as a domestic servant. John was a fireman in the Merchant Navy, and it could well be that Susan met her future husband through one of his colleagues. On the 1911 census, they have all moved to 14 Clovelly Road. Susan and Frederick were now married and were living in 2 rooms of the house and 2 further rooms in this typical Edwardian 2-up-2-down terrace house were occupied by Charlotte Anne, John Henry Hodges, their 2 children and her mother, Elizabeth Pierce, who by now was widowed again. One of the things about the 1911 census is that it tells you how many of the children were alive, but also, uniquely up to that point, how many children had died. Frederick and Susan had 2 sons, both of whom died in infancy. My grandmother, Susan May, was the next child, born in 1907. And then, in 1911, aged just 2 months old at the time of the census, my great-aunt, Annie Frieda, is listed. We know that the first son died shortly after childbirth, but from the death certificate, we can tell that their second son, William George, was only 6 months old when he died of bronchitis, having suffered convulsions for 4 hours before his death. My family, then, were used to tragedy, but weren't quite prepared for the fate that would befall them. We can tell from a few sources what ships Frederick had sailed on prior to embarking on his ultimate fatal trip on Titanic. Family photographs are often a good way to do this. I have another photograph of Frederick from around 1900 in merchant seaman's uniform when he was on the SS Christabel, a wooden barkentine which plied its trade out of Faversham. Frederick looks very fetching in his mariner's cap and thick woolen jumper, both of which depict the name of the ship. On the 1911 census, it is noted that he was on the Atalanta, a liner tender operating out of Southampton Docks, which was owned by the London and South Western Railway. According to Titanic's crew list, his previous ship was Minnehaha. Crew lists and agreements always list the previous ship and are a great way to trace back seafaring ancestors. The Minnehaha was a large liner owned by the Atlantic Transport Line. She usually operated out of London on the transatlantic run to New York, but in 1911 she had a collision and was taken to Southampton for repairs. I believe that it was once she was repaired that Frederick had the opportunity to sail on her from Southampton to New York. On Titanic's crew list, which is very hierarchical, he appears with the engine crew on the 4 to 8 watch, which means he was contracted to be on duty from 4 to 8 a.m. and later that day from 4 to 8 p.m. There were three engine room watches, the 12 to 4 watch, the 4 to 8 watch, and the 8 to 12 watch. When Titanic struck the iceberg at 11:40 p.m. on April the 14th, it was the engine crew who were working on the 8 to 12 watch who had the misfortune to be on duty when the disaster happened. From the crew list, we get an estimation of Frederick Woodford's age, 40, where born and last ship. It is also from the crew lists that we get confirmation of his address at 14 Clovelly Road, Newtown, Southampton. The crew lists start with the deck department, which consists of deck officers, lookouts, quartermasters and able seamen, down to lamp trimmers and a window cleaner. This is followed by the engineer officers and the engine room crew, who consisted not only of greasers, such as my great-grandfather, but also of firemen to stoke the boilers and trimmers who would bring coal to the firemen and level off the coal in the bunkers, helping the ship to maintain an even keel. The victualling department was divided into first, second and third class and consisted of various stewards such as bedroom and bathroom stewards, bar stewards, stewardesses, boot boys and other cleaners, lift attendants, barbers, Turkish bath attendants, swimming pool attendants, a gym instructor and even glory hole attendants. These were the stewards for the crew, looking after the mess rooms, sleeping accommodation and bathrooms that were designated for specific grades and capacities of crew. The victualling department also consisted of restaurant and galley staff, including the finest French chefs and Italian waiters, bakers and patisserie makers. The band were not part of the crew and travelled as second-class passengers. Likewise, a continuity team from Harland and Wolff, headed by the ship's designer Thomas Andrews, also travelled, but not as official crew. When Titanic docked in Queenstown on the 11th of April 1912, Frederick sent a letter to his wife, and this is what it says. "My darling wife, just a few lines to let you know that I am pretty well, and I hope this will find you and the two girls all right. Well, my love, I am sending you on the £1 note and also the 5 shilling one for last Tuesday, so you must go down on Monday and draw it. You must go down to the new road in the docks, and you will see the white star line marked up there on the right, opposite the fire station and the American line shed. Well, my love, hoping this will find you quite well and all, I remain your loving husband, F.E. Woodford." I don't think he was used to writing letters, although his handwriting is very clear, because it seems rather strange for a husband to sign a letter in such a formal fashion. Nevertheless, this letter, now in the possession of my father, would become a treasured possession in light of the disaster that was to follow. The events surrounding Titanic's sinking have been much written about, and one of the ways we can chart a basic timeline through is through the signals that were received by a ship called SS Burma. The telegraphs were produced before the official Board of Trade inquiry as evidence, and that's why they now appear in the National Archives. The first signal was received at 11:45 p.m. on April the 14th, around 5 minutes after Titanic had struck an iceberg. MGY is the code used by Titanic. All ships had a three-letter code to enable them to be identified quickly when sending signals. The first telegraph goes, "SOS from MGY. We have struck an iceberg, sinking fast. Come to our assistance." It also gives their position, latitude 41.46 north, longitude 40.14 west. Burma seeks clarification. "What is the matter with you?" Titanic has another go. "Okay, we have struck an iceberg and are sinking. Please tell captain to come." Burma responds, "MGY, we are only 100 miles from you, steaming at 14 knots. Be with you by 6:30. Unfortunately, 6:30 was going to be far too late. At 1:25, Titanic reply, "OK, old man," but a quarter of an hour later, we can tell that panic had already set in on Titanic. Burma receive a telegram saying, "We are sinking fast, passengers being put into boats." Finally, the very last message received by Burma was sent by telegraphist Jack Phillips, urgently signalling until the very last moment, "Women and children in boats cannot last much longer." By 2:20 a.m, the ship had completely foundered. The international press were quick off the mark, with often wildly inaccurate tales regarding the sinking, stories of survivors and calls for judicial hearings. The local press were in a better position to record the effect of the sinking on the families of the crew and on the community of Southampton. Among the most notable was the Southern Daily Echo, a newspaper that is still at the heart of the community today. The following articles, all from the Echo, provide a poignant insight into what it must have been like for those families in Southampton who were waiting for up to 4 days for news of their loved ones. Tuesday, 16th of April, 1912. Consternation at Canute Road. Rarely, if ever, in the history of the Port of Southampton have such scenes been witnessed as were seen outside the offices of the White Star Line in Canute Road this morning, where the following brief, pregnant message was posted. Titanic foundered about 2:30 a.m. April 15th. About 675 crew and passengers picked up by ship's boats of Carpathia and California. Names of those survived will be posted as soon as received. Dismay and incredulity struggled for the mastery of the anxious crowd as they pressed forward to read the fateful bulletin. For the ambiguity of the message and the absence of any direct mention of loss of life still held out hope, which the more optimistic eagerly clutched at. Wednesday, 17th of April, 1912. Stricken Southampton, a town of mourning, all-night vigil. The pathetic scenes in Southampton yesterday, after the dread news of Titanic's foundering had been confirmed, would have moved even the hardest heart to compassion. All day long there was a crowd outside the White Star offices, comprised for the most part of men, although later in the day numbers of women, many with babies in their arms and toddlers hanging round their skirts, hardly knowing the meaning of the crowd, but vaguely aware that something untoward had happened to Daddy. As darkness grew, the crowds increased, both outside the White Star Line and the West Gate. It was an impressive and withal pathetic scene. Today, Southampton is a town in mourning. In many streets, in almost every house, the breadwinner was on board the ill-fated Titanic, and numberless homes would be left bereft. The White Star Line officers in Canute Road remained open all night, and through the dark watches, the patient crowds in their vicinity and outside the main dock gates maintained their mournful vigil, but no further news came through. Wednesday, 17th of April, 1912, late edition, pathetic scenes at Southampton. Would the fateful names, the publications of which would spell the joyous relief or shatter the last hope, never come through? The period of waiting seemed interminable. The golden sunshine which flooded Dockland only emphasised the contrast between life and death. There are few streets in the town that have not given their toll. In Britain Street, it is said that nearly every house contributed its quota to the crew of the sunken liner, and in one street in Nicholstown, there are 20 distracted households hoping against hope that their loved one or ones are amongst the survivors. From time to time, women with reluctant step backward glances detached themselves from the crowd and went home to get tea for their children, who were all too probably orphans. But the new arrivals on the scene more than compensated for their absence, and by 4 o'clock the crowd assumed its largest dimensions since the news of the disaster leaped through. Thursday, 18th of April 1912, the agonising wait, scenes outside White Star Line offices. Yesterday was practically a repetition of Tuesday. Throughout the day and up to a late hour, haggard-faced men and women, mostly the latter, made their way through the crowds into the office to make inquiries of their dear ones. But to each the answer was the same. No news, although all were informed that they would be told, should any come. It was a strange sight, this crowd of grave, silent men and women, waiting for the yearned-for tidings that might never come. Men and women waiting for a name, just one word that meant to them the whole wealth of difference between life and death. The words that may be written on the board during the coming hours will decide what wives will be widowed, what children orphans, and what sweethearts forlorn. Friday, April 19th, 1912, the anguish of the crowd. The mental torture which is being so bravely borne by the stricken families of Southampton reached its climax last night. Between 6 and 7 o'clock, the excitement and anxiety grew in intensity, for the first message had arrived. The first list of names went up, but it was only too apparent that they were not the names of Southampton's sons. List after list came, but the English names in the first few hundred could be counted on the finger of one hand. A sob of disappointment broke from the hearts of the waiting hundreds, but still they continued their faithful vigil for an hour, with nothing to break the awful monotony of it. Slowly, reluctantly, with many a backward glance at the twinkling lamps illuminating the fateful blackboard, the majority of the crowd melted away. The distress in a few days' time must be terrible. For the vast majority of women absolutely rely on the half pay they receive each Monday. The Mayor's Fund is increasing by leaps and bounds each hour, but every penny will be needed. It is difficult to realise the magnitude of the calamity, but in Northern Council alone, 125 children are dependent upon parents and relatives who were on board Titanic. Friday, April 19, 1912, how Titanic met her doom. By Friday afternoon, clearer news had been received from New York. Iceberg reported too late. Ship ripped open from stern to stern, went the headlines. The great liner went down with the band playing, taking to death all but 775 of the human cargo of 2,340. To this must be added six, five of whom died on Carpathia. Saturday, 20th of April 1912, distress at Southampton. In comparison with the crowds that have thronged Canute Road during the last few days, there were only a small number of people gathered outside White Star Line offices this morning. The worst fears of many a wife, mother and child were realised yesterday, and a deep gloom has settled down over the streets, wherein the seafaring population have their home, a gloom no longer relieved by a ray of hope. Local people reacted swiftly to the tragic events. Memorial services were held across Southampton, and a flag was flown at half-mast from the town hall, and flags were similarly flown on other buildings and churches across the city. Not everything was quite so morbid. A whole community, a whole nation, indeed many nations, were moved, and funds were set up. In association with the Lord Mayor of London, the Mayor of Southampton, Henry Bowyer, established a Titanic Relief Fund, and donations soon came in via newspaper appeals and concerts and charity events. Similar Titanic Relief Funds were also set up in Liverpool, London, Exeter and Belfast. Thousands of people subscribed to the fund, individuals, organisations, seafaring unions and other unions, and indeed the acting community also played their part. One advertisement in the Southern Daily Echo is from the Grand Theatre in Southampton, where Lady Beerbohm Tree and Mr Kenneth Douglas and members of the Chalk Line Company pledged to give 25% of the following week's takings to the Lord Mayor's Fund in aid of the widows, children, orphans and dependents of crew. We shall hear more about the fund later. News was slow to filter through to White Star Line Company themselves. In the early age of wireless telegraphy, it could take a while for accurate information to be passed across. On board Carpathia, Captain Rostron was understandably reluctant to transmit information about survivors until full identities could be established and all procedures followed, which could be done at port. White Star Line had initially informed the Board of Trade that all aboard Titanic had been saved and the ship was being towed to port. This was picked up on by the press, especially those papers stateside who had been eagerly anticipating the arrival of this great ship. On the 16th of April, White Star Line sent a further letter to the Board of Trade from its headquarters in Liverpool, where Titanic was actually registered. Dear Sir, further to our conversation of yesterday, we are extremely sorry to have to send you the following wire this morning. Referring to telegram, Titanic deeply grieved, say that during the night we received word steamer foundered, about 675 souls, mostly women and children saved, which we now beg to confirm. Although it was quick to sort out who had been saved, because only those in the lifeboats picked up by Carpathia would have survived, identification of what bodies could be found later would take some time. Those who made it into the water, such as my great-grandfather, may have lasted half an hour before succumbing to hypothermia in the icy seas. Some, more mercifully, may have broken their necks due to the height of the fall and the buoyancy of the cork life jackets. Others may have drowned, being sucked under with the ship, or through breathing in involuntarily due to the shock of the icy water following their leap. Some others remain trapped on board the ship as it plunged to the depths of the Atlantic Ocean, and their fate is probably the most horrific. The process of picking up what bodies could be found took quite some time, and it was not until the 17th of May that my great-grandmother received a letter from White Star Line, stating rather abruptly to Mrs. F. Woodford, 14 Clovelly Road, Southampton. Madam, we beg to inform you that the body of F. Woodford was recovered by the cable steamer Mackay Bennett and was buried at sea, estimated age 38, brown hair and moustache, British Seafarers Union number 1802. White Star Line chartered two cable-laying vessels from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Mackay Bennett and Minier, to search the area and recover what bodies they could. Mackay Bennett arrived on the scene on the evening of Saturday the 20th of April, and Minier followed on the 26th of April, and a further two ships, Algerine and Mormagny, were hired to search further. In total, 328 bodies were recovered, of which 209 were brought back to Halifax, Nova Scotia, Mackay Bennett being responsible for 206 of them. Bodies were numbered and described, and details of personal effects were taken down. And that is what White Star Line were waiting for before sending out letters to relatives. Having to wait a month for such news, without any finality or closure, must have been heartbreaking. When there is the absence of a body, even if the body is buried at sea and has been identified, the Registrar General will not process a death certificate. After a period of 5 to 7 years, a person can be officially regarded as dead, though. As a result, Frederick Woodford was not processed with a death certificate, and you won't find them for those who died on board Titanic unless their bodies were returned to land. However, the Registrar General of Shipping and Seamen maintain a registry of deaths at sea, and there is an entry for Frederick Woodford in the Registry of 1912 under the reference BT334/52. The entry says, Woodford F. Greaser, aged 40, from Hampshire, 14 Clovelly Road, with details regarding Titanic, its official number, date and location of sinking, port of registry and tonnage. The entries for Titanic may now be found online through the National Archives website, as may the crew lists. The effect of losing a loved one on the pockets of communities in Southampton was disastrous. Frederick Woodford was born in Newtown. According to the 1911 Post Office Directory for Hampshire, Newtown comprised the wards of Nicholstown and Queensland, and was a new self-contained pocket community. Situated in the east of Southampton, above the docks and St Mary's Ward, and to the left of Northam, on the banks of the River Itchen, with its wharves and boatyards, it was a convenient location for many of the merchant navy seamen residing in the city. Separated from Northam by the South Western Railway line, it was less prone to flooding than its neighbour, but still at the time a rather insalubrious place to live. Sickness and diseases such as tuberculosis, pneumonia, diphtheria and scarlet fever were rife, and the majority of the population would have been hard-pressed to pay for the necessary medication to treat the symptoms. Nevertheless, residents could avail themselves of the nearby hospital in Fanshawe Street, the Royal Hants and Southampton Hospital, and general practitioners in St Mary's Road and Derby Road. There was a ladies' school in Cranberry Place, a primary and secondary school in Argyle Road with capacity for 1,629 boys, girls and infants, and the nearby school in York Street, Northam, with the capacity for a further 1,700 pupils. There were public houses in Alfred Street, the Chamberlain Arms, and in St Mary's Road, the Criterion and the Oxford, and several beer retailers. There were numerous shops, especially in the vertically running St Mary's Road, Northumberland Road and Derby Road, including newsagents, butchers and bakers, bootmakers and dressmakers, milliners, tailors, fishmongers, grocers, drapers, greengrocers, chemists, cycle makers, booksellers and binders, confectioners, artificial teeth makers, florists, hotels, auction rooms and a working man's club. In Clovelly Road itself could be found the sub-post office and the Southern Counties Dairy. So you can see that it was very much a community, and one in which in nearly every street there was a loss of life in a few houses. Magnify that across 15 or so communities in Southampton and you have a catastrophe. Everyone would have known somebody who had died on board ship or would have some sort of connection with a crewman, be it relative, neighbour, friend or colleague. In Northam, of 30 crew, 26 lost their lives and 4 were saved. The worst affected residents, though, was the Sailors' Home in Oxford Street in central Southampton, where from 24 crew, 17 lost their lives and 7 were saved. These would have been sailors from Liverpool and other parts of the country who were not normally resident in Southampton. But what of the school children? The logbook of Northam School from 1898 to 1914 is held at Southampton City Archives. Headmistress Miss Annie Hopkins recorded the absences and the effect of the catastrophe on the pupils. Around 40 pupils from this one school lost a father, brother, uncle or cousin to the tragedy. A select sample of the entries from the logbook reads as follows. 1912, April 15th. A great many girls are absent this afternoon owing to the sad news regarding the Titanic. Fathers and brothers are on the vessel and some of the little ones in school have been in tears all afternoon. April 17th. I feel I must record the sad aspect in school today owing to the Titanic disaster. So many of the crew belong to Northam and it is pathetic to witness the children's grief and in some cases hope for better news. Attendance is suffering. May the 7th. I have distributed clothes to the children who were bereft through the Titanic disaster. May the 23rd. The mayoress visited the department this afternoon regarding the orphans of the Titanic victims. Illness among the children got so bad that a hospital box was opened at the school to offer some relief for the sick children and children whose mothers or other dependents were unable to afford treatment. June the 28th, two extra cases of diphtheria were reported today. There are now 74 cases of infectious disease. 1913, February the 20th. The sickness, pneumonia and rheumatism among the children, consequent on the recent floods causing damp in the houses, is very great. Northam was on land reclaimed from the River Itchen, and when there was a high tide, there was considerable danger of flooding. 1 year on, the situation had not improved, and Miss Hopkins penned this poignant entry. 1913, April 15th, today being the anniversary of the Titanic disaster, a great many girls are away on account of mother's illness, and grief in the homes upsetting the children. It is a sad echo of last year. As we have seen, to alleviate the suffering, a fund was set up, the Mansion House Subcommittee Titanic Relief Fund. The minute books are in Southampton City Archives. For the Southampton area, minute book one does not survive. Minute book two commences on the 18th of November 1912. At that point, the board comprised of 20 members, including the Mayor and Lady Mayoress and Mrs. Lightoller, husband of Second Officer Charles Herbert Lightoller, who survived the sinking. By March 1913, £413,202 had been subscribed. As well as direct grants to dependents, the fund also dispensed apprenticeship grants and paid school fees, especially for secondary schools, allowing children to stay in school longer, receive a better education, and hopefully lift themselves out of poverty. For example, in June 1923, the committee discussed raising apprenticeship allowances from £20 to £30 a year. Due to a surplus in the fund of £28,481 over the valuation made in 1922. Money was also set aside for medical treatment and eye and dental care over and above the weekly grants. There were three priests on the panel, and the committee, being anxious that money from the fund should not be abused, were inclined to take certain moral and spiritual decisions. Take the case of Mrs. Biggs. Mrs. Biggs, aged 30, and everybody has a case number, was the mother of fireman Edward Charles Biggs. On the 29th of January 1914, the committee reported that Mrs. Biggs had again been in front of the magistrates on a charge of drunkenness, and it was decided to suspend her allowance for a period of 3 months. On the 23rd of April 1914, they decided that Mrs. Biggs be reinstated to the fund at an allowance of 2 shillings per week, the money to be expended for her benefit and not given in cash. So the fund dispensed money for the benefit of distressed relatives, but many of the payments were organised on their behalf to ensure that the money was best used. The way that the fund was organised reflected the salary and social status of a crewman. No account was made of the fact that the widow of a greaser was just as much, if not more, in need of income support to support the loss of the major breadwinner of the family than an officer of Titanic would be. The scale of the Titanic Relief Fund weekly allowances were as follows. Class A, officers and engineers, widows £2, children 7 shillings and sixpence. Class B, saloon stewards and bedroom stewards, widows £1, 12 shillings and sixpence, children 6 shillings and threepence. Class C, lesser stewards, catering, boots, bakers and bedroom stewards, widow £1, 7 shillings and sixpence, children 5 shillings and sixpence. Class D, further stewards, widow £1, children 3 shillings and sixpence. Class E, second class stewards, and we've seen that there were third, second and first class stewards, stewardesses and senior firemen, widow 17 shillings and sixpence, children 2 shillings and sixpence. Class F, greasers, in which my family found themselves in that bracket, widows 15 shillings, children 2 shillings and sixpence. And finally, Class G, firemen, scullions, trimmers and lower class stewards. Widows 12 shillings and sixpence, children 2 shillings and sixpence. Fund grants were dependent upon the following. Allowance to a widow shall cease upon her remarriage. Allowance to all children shall cease in the case of males at 16 and in the case of females at 18. No allowances shall be made to a dependent other than a widow over the age of 70. Allowances to dependents other than widows and children to cease, 1. For persons under 50, 3 years from the age of commencement, from the date of commencement of the allowance, and 2. For persons aged 50 to 70, until such time as they reach the age of 70. So you can see that they were looking very carefully at how they would manage the fund and how they could make it longer lasting. Deductions were to be made upon receipt of any permanent income and also from any lump sum awarded under the Workmen's Compensation Act. The main fund was reconstituted in 1916 to include victims of the Empress of Ireland and Lusitania tragedies, and was finally wound down in 1959, any residue being dispensed among National Disaster Relief Fund recipients. Titanic Fund minute books are rich in detail, and the following extracts relate to my ancestor, Frederick Woodford, and his family. 29th of May, 1914. Mrs. Woodford, widow, £2. Mrs. Woodford to be sent to Dolling Home at Worthing for 4 weeks, and Susan Woodford, daughter, aged 7 years, to be sent to John Horniman Home at Worthing for a similar period. 17th of July, 1914. 1 quart of milk per day for 13 weeks to Mrs. Woodford, widow. 18th of September, 1914. May Woodford, daughter, to remain at Southbourne Convalescent Home, and Mrs. Woodford returns from Shedfield Convalescent Home. 3 shillings to Mrs. Woodford, extra expenses for getting home. The same meeting they recorded, Anna F. Woodford, daughter, died 13th of August, 1914. 20th of November, 1914. The urgent necessity for treatment at a sanatorium having been reported in the case of Mrs. Woodford, widow, it was decided to recommend Mrs. Woodford to avail herself of the treatment given at the municipal dispensary. None of the convalescent homes survive, but there is still a John Horniman Museum and Foundation. John Horniman was a prosperous tea merchant who, among his many endowments during his lifetime, built a convalescent home at Worthing where 50 poor children from the crowded cities could enjoy the sunshine and breezy air of the southern coast. It may seem strange when you think that they were already on the coast, but it must be remembered that many of the families were suffering from bronchial and other conditions brought on by the damp housing and squalid conditions in which they were living. The final entry is extremely sad. It goes, Woodford, case 273, that by reason of the child becoming an orphan on the death of the mother, the scale allowance of 2 shillings and 6 pence a week be increased to 5 shillings in accordance with the scale, and that in addition, Mrs. Pierce, the child's grandmother, be placed on the fund as a new dependent, personal dependent mother-in-law class F, at 2 shillings a week until she attains the age of 70. So at that moment, having lost her sister, my grandmother was to lose her mother as well. Annie Frieda died of diphtheria and exhaustion, and her mother Susan died of pulmonary tuberculosis. According to her death certificate, she had been suffering from this for over 4 years. You can trace through over successive years the continuance of allowances in the Titanic Fund minute books, until they finally finish with the entry in 1931 where an allowance has been set up for 1932. At that stage, my grandmother was a young lady of 25 and no longer qualified for Titanic money, but had also received a good education. One of the things that the Titanic Fund provided for, as we've heard, was apprenticeship, and the fund paid for my grandmother to receive piano lessons. She became, in turn, a teacher of pianoforte and also played piano in cinemas in Southampton. The money enabled my grandmother to have a far happier childhood. She was able to continue her schooling. She was looked after initially by her grandmother. Unfortunately, Elizabeth Pierce died shortly after her daughters Susan and Annie, and my grandmother's one surviving aunt, Elizabeth, Susan's elder sister, looked after her. She moved in with her in Totten with Elizabeth's husband, Albert Tarrant, and it is in Totten at school where she met my grandfather, Reginald William Cronin, and they were married on the 2nd of September 1933. Despite having a far better life in Totten, the one thing that was always unfortunate for my grandmother was that she believed the letter that had come through from the White Star Line, telling her mother that Frederick's body had been recovered by a ship and was buried at sea. As far as she was concerned, there was nothing she could do. There was no grave she could visit. As it turns out, that was wrong. The McKay-Bennett did indeed recover Frederick's body. It was all duly noted down, but the body was taken back to Halifax, Nova Scotia. Unfortunately, through a clerical error, for the best part of 90 years, his grave remained unmarked, and my grandmother died in ignorance of the fact that her father's body was at rest in Canada. At this point, I'm going to take up the story in the words of my cousin, Virginia, who visited Halifax without knowing there was a grave there. She had an interest in maritime matters and also in things with the Titanic connection and knew there was a connection with Halifax, but had no idea of what she might find there. This is an extract of a letter she wrote to Mr. Jack Eaton of the Titanic International Society. My family and I believe that my great-grandfather, Frederick Woodford, had been drowned on the Titanic, recovered by the cable steamer McKay-Bennett and buried at sea. In 2002, my husband and I decided to visit Canada, and one of the places we stayed at was Halifax, which we knew had a Titanic connection, being the place where the recovered victims were brought. However, as my great-grandfather was buried at sea, this fact was not of apparent interest. We visited the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic and discovered that the victims, who had been brought to Halifax, had been buried in a special section of the city cemetery. In the hope of finding a special memorial, we walked all the way to the cemetery. It's a long way on foot, and many times we thought of giving up the wild goose chase as we wandered through the suburbs of Halifax. Eventually we got to the cemetery and began to read the information boards about the Titanic section. As we read down the final board, we suddenly made the momentous discovery that my great-grandfather had not been buried at sea, but was lying just a few yards away from where we stood. I was the first of his descendants to visit his grave, almost 90 years to the day he was buried there. Sadly, my grandmother died in 1985, never knowing that her father had been buried in Halifax. This was particularly poignant, as she had once told me how sad it was that she had no grave to visit. Her mother's and siblings' graves were removed by Southampton City Council. Little did she know that her father's unknown grave existed. Jack Eaton sent a very nice reply, which I shall close with. Your great-grandmother's loss in 1912 was compounded by the fact that Mr. Woodford's identification, body number 163, and disposition were known from the start. A handwritten list in my possession shows under Mr. Woodford's name that a burial permit was issued on May the 2nd, 1912, and that burial was at the Fairview Cemetery on May the 6th. The letter to your great-grandmother demonstrates the extreme confusion that existed immediately following the disaster. And that's where I'd like to end this talk. My grandmother never got to pay her respects to her father, but my cousin has, and with this talk, I too am paying respects to my great-grandfather, Frederick. Thank you very much for listening.
This event was recorded live on the 3rd of April 2012 at the National Archives, Kew. This podcast is copyrighted to the National Archives. All rights reserved.